Morning.
Good morning, Mel. How are you? Thanks for turning up after a couple of weeks away. How's it
It's all right. I was in Poland last week, actually.
been? Really? For a presumably a nuclear industry conference?
It's the one I go to every year, the big industrial economic forum, they call it. So yeah, I took part in one of the sessions and did a couple of went to another couple of them, pick up the view. Poland's just ordered its first nuclear stations. So it's quite a interesting topic over there. So working out now how actually to do it practically, having taken the decision and signed the papers, beginning to realise that it's quite a logistical challenge.
Yeah, so Donald Tusk at the helm there, ex of the EU, it seems to be the major beneficiary of European money. They haven't had a great deal of time, I suppose, as he was elected not long before Starmer was, to get their ducks in a row. Did you have an impression of how the place is looking?
No, I mean, Poland is, and Eastern Europe generally has taken a very different attitude towards immigration from Western Europe and Northern Europe. So I mean, I was out in the Silesian mountains. I didn't really get much of a feel for city life in Poland, but it's they are, they and Hungary are really taking a stand against the Islamization of their societies, which they see, not completely
Well, a
without merit
hostile one,
at this
exactly,
point.
but it just because of cultural domination is at risk.
The country, I mean, their economic performance Poland is just extraordinary. They've been really ever since the fall of communism, their economy has been growing very, very rapidly. It grew throughout COVID, obviously not the same rate it was doing otherwise, but they it came through COVID in a better state than vast majority of places, and they've very vigorous industrial sector. Very, very interesting country to watch at the moment.
What is that quality? I used to find that in Germany in the 80s of kind of hit the ground running industrial capability. Somebody rocks up to
Well,
fix
Germany, of
something,
course.
however every day it is, and it's done with the virtuosic speed and efficiency.
Yeah, and I think it needs a clarity of vision, and it needs a recognition of just how desperately important, economic activity generally, but manufacturing and industrial activity being a serious part of that. Because Germany, of course, is going in the other direction. Its major industries are really fleeing now. Their renewables policies resulted in some of the highest energy prices in Europe. And there are real questions about the stability of the power supplies in Germany, as the amount of unreliable input, wind and solar into the grid increases. And a lot of major companies now are leaving Germany. And the Germany, which post-war was the economic miracle as to how they rebuilt the devastated country after the Second World War into one of the most impressive industrial powerhouses in the world. They seem to have lost the recognition of how important that is, and thought that they could follow some of these rather silly policies, I think, industrial policies, thinking that, well, we're Germany, everybody's going to stick with us because we're the miracle. And they're just beginning to find out that it's not as simple as that.
Is it a question then of, as it were, of them believing their own BS in terms of the ideation of what's going on, as opposed to the impact on the ground? You've spoken quite a bit about is it Energiewende
Yeah,
that
the
has been the
Energiewende,
fork in the road that has has sort of hamstrung that the continuation of that success.
I think that's right. I think there's been quite a lot of statements made. It's not just Germany, but Germany's a stark example of where quite optimistic, shall we say, ideological statements have been made about various industrial policies, particularly this myth about renewables in practice being cheap to operate. And then reality comes and bites you because you install them all, and you find that you're then having to destroy, massive irony in Germany. They have to demolish a wind farm to get at the coal reserves underneath it so they could This is brown coal, the worst, you know, the least efficient, the most environmentally damaging form of coal.
Which
So they had
focus of this,
to
I think, wasn't it? Yeah.
destroy a wind farm to get at this coal to burn in their power stations. They're still generating, you know, on average between 10 and 20 times as much carbon per unit of electricity as France is with the big French nuclear program. So it's not helping particularly environmentally. They have come a long way with renewables, but yeah, keeping a major industrial grid going when you can't be sure whether your inputs are going to happen or not is a much, much more difficult and expensive business than having a properly planned one where you've got reliable sources, nuclear, gas, coal, to an extent, where you can plan the output against what your expected demand. You know that these sources are going to be available for you. You know that a few of them might break down, but generally speaking, they're what they call dispatchable. You can switch them on when you need them and switch them off when you don't. I think Germany is perhaps the foremost example of showing that actually the laws of physics don't respect political ideology, and countries that believe they can, there's certainly a bit of hubris about this, I think, may well discover that the world doesn't behave the way it wants it to.
Do you have counterparts in Germany to whom you've spoken about this?
I know quite a few people who have continually worked in Germany. I mean, from the nuclear point of view, I think Germany has been a lost cause, although they did extend some of their stations for a while. But there's a because the rule, I mean, we're aware politics in Germany at the moment is extremely fraught with the Alternative for Deutschland, which is very pro-nuclear, making significant gains. What they describe as the far right party. In Germany, making significant gains in the recent regional elections in East Germany. We've got this coalition of the Greens and the SPD nationally, which looks very, very fragile and is rightly, I think, taking the blame for a lot of Germany's difficulties.
The
So,
one
how
that went
stable
to
that is
the
looking.
Southampton Kraft 9 Danker in the 80s.
Yeah, that's right. The Christian Democrats, who, yeah, under Merkel, were the ones who actually enacted the nuclear phase-out policy. But the Christian Democrats do seem to be swinging back towards a more realistic industrial policy. But in Germany, as you know, as we've seen from time to time, to a lesser extent in the UK, but still a very notable extent, the old certainties that you saw in France with the socialists and the conservatives in France, you had them in Germany, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats in the UK, obviously Labour and Conservative, where all of those countries, not all that long ago, were in effect two-party states where you would see the government switch from one to the other from time to time. Now, of course, it's massively fragmented. In France, you've got the just the appearance of Macron, the Macron party, which pretty much wiped out the socialists. And now in France, the two traditional ones, the ones that produced the likes of Chirac and Mitterrand and Hollande, so on, are only picking up single figures in votes, sometimes slightly more than that, but. Nowhere near the position they were. Same in Germany, where the predominance of the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats is much diminished. And of course, in the UK, the election this year was the lowest percentage of votes going to the two major parties. So, you know, little more than 50% of the vote went to Labour and Conservative. Where, of course, if you go back to the 50s, Labour and Conservative between them were picking up 92-93% of the vote, and we were very much a two-party system.
Well, we will eventually have great British energy, but it sounds to me it's across Europe, as it were, the case for public awareness, public assent to these sorts of policies, with their environmental compromises, and surprising conclusions, as you often helpfully point out to us, as opposed to the greenwash aspect, needs perhaps representation. So Graham, good morning. Thank you very much for coming back
Yeah.
after a couple of weeks away. It's good to be back in the eerie here. We started talking about in the general tilt of van der Leyen's re-election and who she's got doing what. The fact that Malcolm was at a conference in rural Poland up in the mountains the other week, and that led us to what's going on with energy policy in Poland, who seemed to be doing quite well, Germany rather less well.
Greenwashing is winning, you know. I mean, that's a very good article by Georges Monbiot,
Indeed, yes, yeah,
setting out
it's
all.
a bitter pill to swallow, isn't it?
It's the technology just amplifies the effect, because the greenwash can be spread that more much more easily. But this is what happened in the 70s, with the formation of the UK ISIS, International Solar Energy Society, at the Royal Institution, which had all the scientists and experts debating every month the best technologies and going through all the technologies and setting out when they'd be financially viable, economically viable.
So here's Leonie, and hopefully Graham will be back in a second as well.
Hi, Leonie.
Hello. Finally.
Hi, Leonie. Thank you very much. Thanks for your persistence. I've had a few technological issues, as they say, this morning. Someone else is new. Anyway, how have
Well,
you been?
if you think you've got technological issues, you should try being TfL or part of the GLA group at the moment.
Well, I think one or two of us from time to time have issues with TfL, which seems to be rather impenetrable. But through your good offices, I think we may create a portal of communication. So
Well,
maybe that's something we could return to. We were talking.
apparently they've arrested a 14-year-old boy from Walsall or Watford or somewhere, who decided that he was going to create his own portal. So we've been undergoing a massive cyber attack. So they've
Blimey,
started,
O'Reilly.
so they've been closing down all our systems to stop the attack being successful.
He's not, and he's not sort of disgusted of Tunbridge Wells for the cyber era, is he?
I don't know. I
Sure,
mean,
it's not fun. And but to attack transport system is an extraordinarily voluble thing to do. I mean, what motivates someone to do that? Anyway, noble
well,
work, guys.
if you got into the TfL systems, they store people's names and addresses and
Of course.
dates of birth so that they can decide whether or not they're due a travel card. Because you get freebie travel cards, the Freedom Pass, that sort of thing. Or you can get zip cards if you're under 18, but I think it's the sort of, older people. Bank account
I've
details
got a
so that
stagger
people
card somewhere. Yeah.
bank account details so that people can set up auto pay. So if you can get a hold of somebody's name, address, date of birth, and their credit card details, you could do quite a lot of impersonation and internet fraud and all that sort of thing. I mean, they've got a lot of valuable data. So the
14. Yeah.
countermeasures that they've been taking, because TfL provides the IT support for pretty much the whole of the GLA group, that's been a move that David Bellamy has implemented instead of us having all separate IT. So the countermeasures have affected everybody, even people that don't work for TfL. And they've included things like being unable to use your computer to access the internet, which makes it rather awkward. Not being able to go onto external websites. Lots of things have been shut down. Currently, most of my kit doesn't even allow me access onto any of the City Hall systems. This is my I'm talking to you on my smartphone. This is the only device that's currently allowing me access to my own emails.
So this driver that jackknifed last night, I very much got the easiest end of this. This is why I'm holding my computer together with a bit of string and some gaffer tape this morning. But yeah. Oh, Mrs. Trellis, thank you very much, dear. But the vulnerability and the sort of decision making is something Mal and I were talking about, and also Graham, if it hopefully can rejoin us. with regard to the reconstitution of the EU, which and its various subcommittees, which have been sort of repopulated by a newly re-elected Ursula von der Leyen. And there must be somebody somewhere who has oversight for this sort of thing, because it's vitally important. By contrast, we were also talking, Mal and I, about the way Poland's energy policy, for example, Polish government and Polish builders seem to be soaring away the way that Germans did in the Grand Coalition days of the 80s and beyond, whereas in Germany it's not gone terribly well. Von der Leyen is the ex-German defense minister. So I'm wondering what's good in the water, what the problems may be, whether, it might be a bit tendentious, your situation at the GLA at the moment with regard to cyberspace is kind of a paradigm.
Well, I hope it isn't, because it's
well,
not
it's
a very...
in its solution as well, and they'd be hasten to it, I don't, you know, which I'm sure will be rapid.
The main solution, once we've finished shutting down all our systems and shoved out the cyber attacker, seems to be that we have to reset all of our kit with new passwords. So that's
going to take a while, isn't it?
I'm sure that's only a surface. That's the bit that we see. I'm sure there's still
people will be forced to rock up and sit next to each other. I mean, probably a great length.
Well, that's going to be awkward because we've got hot desking, so there aren't enough seats anymore.
Yeah.
So people will be able to book an appointment to come and see IT and then leave again. They won't be encouraged to stay in the building.
Imagine that on the scale of the EU, and it's humongous.
I know.
Isn't it?
I'm thinking about that. That's quite astonishing. Yes, I mean, I think Donald Tusk coming back in as the president of Poland is a very good thing. And obviously, he has held senior roles within the EU before taking on the Polish presidency. So, you know, he's very close to them. And yes, there do seem to be some problems and issues in Germany, some of which were ones that Angela Merkel suffered from, mainly this influx of immigrants, which has landed on very stony territory, particularly in the east, and has led to these recent regionalized elections where they've seen huge gains by the AfD, which is the party that's that which stands for Alternative für Deutschland, who believes the alternative for Germany should be that they chuck out everybody who's Turkish or Syrian or et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, there were Turks all over Dortmund, I remember. The Turkish community was a vital presence, as were the Italians a bit. Some of them were a bit Sicilian, yeah.
Mm. Well, they've had Turkish immigrants, Gastarbeiter.
Mm. Yes.
Gastarbeiter, as they called them back in the
day. They were and are, yes.
Guest workers. Well, some of them aren't anymore. They're not guest workers because they've been there for, you know, decades now, and speak perfect German, of course. So if you go to Turkey, there's lots of people who speak excellent German all over Istanbul. So there's sort of still strong family connections.
So this is where the rhetoric has to catch up with people's social reality and the fact that the degree of integration has successfully occurred.
But we have the same problem here, don't we? I mean, the vote for UKIP and the vote for Brexit, and in the most recent general election, the vote for Reform UK, and a lot of what they've been promoting is the same sort of anti-immigrant stuff. And indeed, enough people in London, which is always seen as a bastion of liberalism and multiculturalism and being welcoming to immigrants. You know, we've seen the election of an assembly member from Reform UK, which means they got more than 5% of the vote in London because we have a threshold. So, you know, it's widespread across Europe. The same in the Netherlands, actually. Geert Wilders has been rather successful, and his party of and you know, again, very anti-immigration, so it's quite wise. Giorgio Meloni in Italy,
who Starmer has been talking to recently, was somewhat beguiled by, I think. Yeah,
I know, he was in Italy last week when I was in Italy actually as well.
Oh right,
not together. I was I was relaxing in Sicily, whereas he looked rather busy.
Well, I'm glad you had a nice time, and presumably still relatively warm down there.
Was.
Beautiful thought. Anyway, just pausing, as it were, for breakfast on the balcony, virtually speaking. Here we are back in London, and with these pressing problems. Let's unpack this a little bit. The Austrian Prime Minister, as was, I think, is now going to be in charge of EU immigration policy. The piece in the Gorniad by Paul Taylor suggests that van der Leyen is strategically tacking right on these issues. So we've got a couple of things in play here. We've got the energy sclerosis. We've got Poland soaring away. Malia were at a conference there last week when Leonie was in Sicily. What is Joe Public to make of this as an entry to the political system? Maybe, as it were, that reformed 14-year-old once he's stopped being naughty. Are you there, Mel?
Sorry, Carol, I'll say that again.
Yes, sorry, that was a rather convoluted question. I was thinking about the fact that the former Austrian Prime Minister, so just tacking to the right with van der Leyen tacking to the right somewhat, it's been suggested by the Gordian report by Paul Taylor on immigration. We have that going on. We also have the sclerosis and soaring away in energy policy we were discussing. In other words, how these people are going to be energized and resourced. So it's a bit of a mixture. And Leonie was referring there to right tackings in the Netherlands and, of course, over here, a London Assembly member. So what are we to make of that in terms of political diagnosis?
Well, I mean, I think there is a real issue around the effect of open borders in Europe. We've got this just extraordinary. It's very difficult to avoid words like invasion when there's several hundred people,
Interesting that, isn't it?
almost all of them youngish men coming across the channel in the boats with no real thoughts from any of the parties, including reformers, to how to deal with that. Germany is now beginning to close its borders and move away from, and there's been interesting questions to how that meshes with the Schengen agreement, which has allowed absolutely free movements across much of Europe. The UK never joined Schengen, but Ireland did, for example. So free movement is under question. And Sweden is taking quite strong measures now, because there are in all of these countries quite, significant groups now of Islamists who are saying, "This is not your country anymore. We're going to take you over. We're going to breed you out." And history seems to be backing that up. So it's a terrible dilemma that I was around in the ward yesterday. And met a new chap, in the young Islamic guy, absolutely charming, but nice chap. And then, as I'm going around, he suddenly chases after me with a can of Coke in his hand and said, "Oh, I found this. You might like this." Yeah, just absolutely, wonderful, charming, warm, community-minded guy. And it's and we've got a very large Ahmadiyya Muslim
Yeah,
community
that's terrific, aren't they?
in and around my ward, who are, great people for
Took
they are
a leg out of
always
arm
looking
recently.
they're always looking for ways to help the community and to look after people who are less well off, and they derive that from their faith. So as often with this, it is possible with pretty much any faith to interpret it in the way that you want to and see it as a source of kindness or a source of viciousness. But there's something about a particular strain of extreme Islamism, which at the moment we don't, I think, see in any of the other religions. And if Europe doesn't make some, recognize this and do something to deal with this, then there are two dangers. First is a general swing away from immigration as a whole, and the second is a rise in Islamophobia, which I think both of those are avoidable. But they're not avoidable unless the political establishment, firstly, I think it's unconscionable of of the present government, which has just, come up with this phrase "far right," which is now just used indiscriminately against anybody who doesn't who doesn't agree with the government, it seems to be. And there's a real danger there of demonizing a lot of people who are, you know, this isn't a personal issue against the individuals they know, but it's a general fear about where we're going, where Sadiq Khan has said he wants to build 40,000 homes for Muslims near mosques. Is he doing the same near the synagogues? Is he doing the same near the churches or the temples?
I suppose the synagogues might naturally fall into the way they design their own communities. You know, think of Edgware, Golders Green, but yeah, sure. And in terms of provision overall, I'd take your point. Yeah,
there's a danger that if you end up assuming, and with the, I mean, I don't know if Leonie's got a view on this, but the enormous general sense of sleaze that's around the government about these, what on earth is a prime minister doing, getting somebody else paying for his glasses and his wife's clothes?
Saving his money on security.
And this, you know, Prince William goes to Villa Park most weeks, sits there with the old with the managers and the ex players and so on. Rishi Sunak regularly went to soccer matches and about this. And Starmer saying, firstly, that he has to go to hospitality for security. Well, okay, but he doesn't have to. He can still pay for his own ticket. He's a multimillionaire on a salary that most people would die for. And I think the danger of this growing sense that this, which I don't think is fair, but it's a growing sense that the new government actually is in exactly the same mould as its predecessor, that its senior figures are in there for all they can get. I saw one tweet today saying that Labour is rich people trying to persuade poor people, pretending to be poor people and trying to persuade poor people that other rich people are the problem. With this, I think the new government is behaving better, or the leadership of the new government is really behaving.
Depressingly, plays to the far right.
Fun. Well, it's all played into the same thing. These aren't so, they're not really interested in us. They're feathering their own nest, which, of course, was a claim levelled not unfairly at the previous government as well. And the more that you get this just appalling behaviour in public life and feathering their own nests of Conservative and Labour alike, then the more likely it is that people are going to turn away from that, and the more attractive it is to vote for Trump or for Reform or whoever it happens to be.
And small government, because it's innately flawed, the usual tropes that Reagan used to come out with. Yeah, Leonie, do you see Malcolm's argument there?
To a degree. I mean, I think he's exaggerating for the sake of effect. I think that, you know, there's obviously going to be a lot of scrutiny of the people at the top of the Labour government, particularly because most of our media in this country is run by people who aren't particularly sympathetic to Labour.
I mean, they can have a rough ride, yeah, sort of thing.
I think that's bound to happen. And therefore, I think, they should be squeaky clean, and anything that they've done that doesn't look squeaky clean is going to be delved into and poured over, and have articles written about it. And, and it's hard to justify some of the things that Malcolm has just been referring to.
You need an Alistair Campbell, don't you? But equally, his colleagues on the right of the spectrum would have done a similar job or attempted to.
So, I think perhaps some of the things that Keir has done have been a bit ill-advised. But, at the end of the day, I would still rather have this government than the previous one, which I think had, substantially run out of steam. There was a very plentiful King's speech launched in July, not long after they were elected. I think there's a lot of ministers now who are of a much higher calibre than some of the ministers in the previous government, who were just becoming an embarrassment. I think it's important to remember some of the sort of outriders in the last government who were doing and saying pretty appalling things. And, you know, they were stopping certain things that we really need to be getting on with. I know that Malcolm may have different views, perhaps, to myself and Graham about the route towards net zero and how that should be achieved. But at least we've now got a government that's going to try and get there, whereas the previous government, you know, was sort of floundering around and coming up with things and saying, oh, we're going to ban new gas boilers from 2030. Oh, no, we're not. We're going to ban new vehicles. All cars from 2030 need to be electric vehicles. Oh, we've changed our minds again. That is not how you get investment into our country. That's not how you get people who produce electric vehicles or all the alternatives to gas boilers, all of these things. You know, you're not going to get people manufacturing at pace and installing at pace if you're not clear and if you sort of wobble backwards and forwards. And that's just on two areas there. So I don't think we're going to see that. I think we will always see the papers with some flim-flam around. I mean, you know, they said ridiculous things about some of the members of the Conservative government, which I don't think we bothered to spend too much time on in these podcasts either. So, you know, I think we should stick to the main issues. You know, the papers and the online platforms will do, you know, all their usual stuff.
I think, if I understand correctly, this Mal's point there was also that was the optics of this, which I grant you are unavoidable. These things can happen in the rush of a great many important decisions that have to be made at pace. Is that it plays to the optics that says, well, basically we might be better off without the whole lot of them. That seems to be fermenting in Central Europe. Meantime, there's Starmer's meeting Bologna and various other people to hopefully get things done. But it's also a question perhaps of how much we can get done flying solo and how we make agreements with some European leaders who are tacking in various directions, mainly to the left, to the left in France a bit. How we break bread with these people and are in alliance perhaps in all but name.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that's why it's good to see that so far Starmer has seen, he's been to France, he's been to Germany, and he's been to Italy, and he's seen the French president, he's seen the German chancellor, and he's seen Giorgia Meloni most recently, as we were just saying. So I think that's really important. Those are the sort of three big powers who originally set up the EU along with the Benelux smaller countries. And they do remain very central to a lot of the decision making in Europe. And as you've just pointed out, you know, we've got Ursula von der Leyen bringing in Italian people into key positions. So I think, you know, he's done the right thing with going there, which is more than can be said for Sunak or Johnson or Truss. You know, they had a very strong anti-Europe rhetoric, which I think has now died down. That's not to say that we're just about to say, oh, let's cancel Brexit. And we'll enter back in or anything like that.
Brexit, I'd rather like that. Yeah.
Yes,
she's an MEP somewhere. Yeah.
Cancel Brexit or even cancel Brexit. You know, that's not going to happen. And Keir's been very clear about that side of things. But I think, you know, what the Germans are deciding to do about migration and immigrants and their borders, what the Italians are doing as well, they've been doing some processing of some of the people who tried to.
Devolution in Italy as well, yeah. Mm.
Well, Italy's always not really been one country. It's always been a sort of federation.
It's been a bit of a somewhat fancy coalition, yeah.
If you go there, you realise how federated it is, although it is one country. It's very interesting. People have a very strong sense of regional identity. To be fair, so do we in this country. And
it's a thing to be nurtured, I guess, but it's a question of who by.
Well, I mean, it's hilarious.
Rules for Oswestry Street, you know, yeah.
It's hilarious in one sense that we call ourselves the United Kingdom because I mean, there's an argument that says that we're a pretty disunited kingdom, but that's maybe a separate argument. So I think he's doing the right thing. I think he's making all of the right moves. I think, you know, David Lammy has been going to all the right places as well. And then hopefully that's going to pay off with the changes that they want to make with the border guard that they want to try, you know, set up, because we have got to tackle this business of, you know, people, smugglers, persuading people to spend millions on getting into boats that are manifestly unsafe. And we have to try and stop that.
So is van der Leyen's light tack under the Austrian Prime Minister, how is that going to benefit or otherwise what we might seek to do about this? Because, Mal, do you want to come in?
I mean, firstly, it's worth noting that the terms of left and right are extremely movable feasts. And when the common market was first formed, it was basically, you know, a free trade bloc, which is a, you know, traditionally a right of centre political stance. And it was the Conservatives who raved over it and were massively in favour of it because it was a free market capitalist friendly bloc. And in those days, it was Labour where you found the real opposition to the EU, the Tony Benns, the Peter Shaws, the Michael Foots, around the time of the UK entry into Europe in the early 70s. Then it switched into the other direction. It became much more of a interventionist body with
Jenkins,
a set of laws that were then handed down to national governments, and that was you ended up with, you know, broadly speaking, the left in Europe. So Tony Blair, Roy Jenkins, the great supporters of the EU, and it was the right that started to become a bit more sceptical about it. Now that Europe as a whole is, you know, the UK being the striking exception, but Europe as a whole, politics are moving towards what one might call the right again. I think, yeah, rightly, the EU needs to reflect that and to move in that kind of direction.
So I'm not sure it's painful, then.
Either surprise. Yeah. Nor am I sure it's all that dramatic. There have been, there are 27 commissioners. They do come from a range of political views, I think it reflects, goes back to what we were saying right at the start before Leonie joined us about how not so many decades ago in countries like Germany and France and the UK, there were two parties, a right of centre party and a left of centre party, who would exchange political control every now and then, but between them would pick up a very, very large proportion of the vote. Now we've seen the traditional left and right parties have pretty much disappeared in France, not doing all that much better in Germany, and even in the UK, where first past the post protects the major parties significantly. In the last election, less than 60% of those who voted for Labour or Conservative. And inevitably, when you've got that degree of fragmentation in politics, governance becomes a lot more difficult than it does when you've got a simple majority of people who are clearly in favour of one or the other traditional governing parties, and you have a clear-cut opposition from the other traditional governing party, which is putting the pressure on and ready to take over. I'm looking at the by-elections this week. They've been really fascinating. There's a couple still not declared up in Stockton, which were Conservative defences. But of course, quite a lot of by-elections are happening because the councillors have just been elected into Parliament. So inevitably, there's rather more Labour by-elections than others because they won an awful lot more parliamentary seats. But we've seen of the Labour defences, so there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Labour defences we've got results on. They held on in Cornwall, but on a 22% swing to the Lib Dems. They held on in Hartlepool, but with a 15% swing to Reform, and Reform came very close to winning that seat. They held on in Harrow Road in Westminster, but with a 24% swing to the Greens. And then all the others, they lost. So they lost to the Lib Dems in Bromsgrove on a 26% swing. They lost the West End seat in Westminster on a 10% swing to the Tories. That went to the Tories. They lost a seat in Worthing to the Tories on a 14% swing. They lost a seat in Gedling, which is Leicestershire, to the Tories on a 14% swing. Massive, massive collapses in the Labour vote in these seats, and they're a mixture of what you call traditional Labour, like Harrow Road in Westminster, but others where them perhaps more naturally Conservative territory. Tories shouldn't be too cheerful because they lost a seat to an independent in Cambridgeshire and actually slipped down to third in the poll there. So it's not unalloyed good news for the Conservatives, but this fresh into a new government, you would be expecting the sort of the aura of the win to do. You know, generally speaking, parties do that are newly in government do pretty well for probably a year or two until those. And the Tories had a very good year in local government in 2020 and 2021. And I don't know, I'm sure that there must be real alarm bells among many of the Labour people who waited so long to be in power to see that you can't read too much into by-elections, but these are remarkably consistent. In every case, the Labour vote has had a 10% plus swing, and in some cases as high as 25% swing to the nearest rival. That must be an issue for real concern this early into a new parliament.
I suppose there might be, as Leonie was suggesting, a situation where the Tory high command and leadership were pretty much damned and lambasted by the grassroots, but the grassroots are still pushing through. Leonie?
I mean, as ever with these things, I'm not sure you can read across into anything else or wider mood. I mean, certainly the West End by-election, there was an announcement by the Mayor of London on Tuesday talking about pedestrianising Oxford Street, which is about as popular as bubonic plague amongst the people that live near Oxford Street. So,
like Whitball Street being presumably bedecked with the traffic that's currently going up down Oxford Street, and it's like,
so you know, an awful lot of the people voting in the West End by-election, including people who have just voted Labour at the general election, are really against any proposals to pedestrianise Oxford Street. So that is completely unsurprising that we've just lost that by-election whilst we held on in Harrow Road. I mean, that is really not surprising. But I don't think, because of that issue, which I think has changed minds, that you can read anything across into views generally about the Labour government. And I'm sure we could go through most of the others and find similar sorts of things. I mean, as you know, Malcolm, often with a by-election, look, I mean, I was actually at my own count back in May, and I watched myself and also the Mayor of London winning very handsomely. You know, I got a very, very good majority in the West Putney ward in Wandsworth. And then the by-election in West Putney, the vote was counted, and the seat, which had been held by a Labour councillor with a majority of about 75, went to the Tories with a majority of almost 500. And on the same day, people were able to differentiate between casting plentiful votes for both myself and for the mayor, and then to vote, obviously, quite dramatically against Labour. So, and that again was on a very local issue, and it was on the same day. So it was very apparent that people weren't, anti-Labour in West Putney. And in fact, I was at the count in the town hall for the general election, and again, you know, Fleur won in West Putney ward. In fact, Labour won in every single ward in Wandsworth. When it comes round 2026 for the council elections, Labour will not win in every seat in every ward in Wandsworth any more than they will, in most places. I mean, there are a couple of London boroughs where there is a very strong and has from time to time been almost 100% Labour. But usually that doesn't happen. And I think people are very canny these days and able to differentiate between a by-election for a council, voting for the Mayor of London, voting for an Assembly member or voting for an MP. So I don't agree that we can read across that there's been a huge change of heart against the national government.
There's clearly merit in what Leonie says, and there's always local factors, and the turnout tends to be extremely low in local elections, which blunts their significance. But having said all that, when you're defending seven seats, and in every single case you have a swing of between 10 and 26% against you, sometimes it's a swing to the Lib Dems, sometimes it's a swing to Reform, sometimes it's a swing to the Conservatives, then it looks similar to the we'll vote tactically to get Labour out in the same way that people were voting tactically to get the Conservatives out in the general election a couple of months ago. And this might all blow over. There are only seven by-election seats, but the consistency across them, while it is true that there are local factors in elections, but having said that, if it were the case that the national party that you were standing for had no effect on how someone voted for you in the local election, then the national parties wouldn't bother to organise. Obviously, quite a lot of people in local elections vote based on their impression of how the party is doing nationally, just as there are others who will vote differently from that. So I think and I hope I didn't exaggerate the significance of this, you can't do that and things can change. But equivalently, when you've got seven seats which have very consistently voters seem to have gone out and looked for the most likely party to defeat that. So you've got a 24% swing to the Greens, a 26% swing to the Lib Dems, a 14% swing to Conservatives, 15% swing to Reform. You know, whoever was the main contender in those areas seems to be the one that people have picked. And it may be the case that all these have unique factors that specifically work against Labour, but a lot of these were in seats where Labour was not the governing party. So you can't blame the policies of the Labour Council at that time. Cornwall, Falmouth seat in Cornwall. Cornwall is still Conservative controlled at this moment, I think. But Labour hasn't got a big presence there, but they had a big swing against them there. Cambridgeshire isn't Labour, but that was the one the Tories had trouble with. So, it's in between the two. Don't exaggerate the importance of these, but also I think, and it's coming up, I don't know if it's happening for Leonie, but it's coming up on the doorstep of a sense of disillusionment. I mean, I've got no axe to grind. I was absolutely no fan of the previous Conservative government by any stretch of the imagination. But it is noticeable. It's coming up where people are just feeling a sense of disappointment. They can't believe that it's a Labour government which has turned on pensioners over the winter fuel payments, and they can't believe that. Or they're cynically unsurprised, but still a bit disappointed when it's a Labour prime minister who turns out to have had the greatest number of freebies. With maybe the exception of Johnson, who was equally egregious in this respect, but it's just absolutely milking donors. And people say, these donors really giving all this money and not expecting anything in return? So it's the kind of sense of Labour stances. We're not quite as bad as the Tories used to be in every respect, except for the winter fuel payments. I wanted more from this government. I wanted it to do what it said it was going to do and move away from this crony culture of top people making huge amounts of money out of being prime ministers. I don't think Gordon Brown ever did that. I don't think John Major ever did that. I don't think Theresa May ever did that. There are many of those around who have been true public servants from both major parties. And we needed a clean break, and I'm afraid people just don't think they're getting it.
Can I throw something in the mix here? I noticed, I happened to notice on X, it's now called George Galloway doing a hustings meeting as the national leader of the Workers' Party with the local candidate. Obviously, they didn't particularly do a light, but there's a national figure, as it were, zooming in on the local in the hope of building the case for that particular movement. At the same time, somebody who I've just noticed as David, whoever they might be, I haven't given a second name, has worn something called what's it called? Blue UK Parliament. I've got the name wrong, but the idea is blue collar Parliament is the correct moniker. It's the idea that evisceration over time, for whatever reason, the demise of things perhaps like Ruskin College, the Trade Union College in Oxford for women and what have you, has perhaps been a contributory factor towards the lack of representation, particularly perhaps in this present government, in contrast to the Lee Andersons out of this world, out of the recent Tory government, and now Reform UK, of what about the workers? Now, is this a thing? And is it a good thing that apparently the Labour conference is going to be the first arena at which this is discussed? And how can it be resolved? Is it a problem?
I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to actually look at the breakdown of the latest cohort of mainly Labour MPs who've come into Parliament. I mean, don't forget, Lee Anderson was actually given his break by Labour. It was
Oh,
Labour that
that's an important point. He was a local councillor, wasn't he, originally?
he also worked for the local MP as well, who was Labour at the time. I mean, he's been on, as they say, he's been on quite the political journey before he ended up where he is now. So, he's a bit of a traveller, Mr. Anderson. But I do think there is still quite a number of people from pretty humble backgrounds who are now in Parliament, not least the Prime Minister and the
Son of a
Deputy.
toolmaker, son of a bus driver.
And the Deputy Prime Minister, who, I mean, quite a lot of people say to me that they don't like Angela Rayner because they think she sounds common. So,
Oh,
I mean,
sounds a bit misogynist, doesn't it? Anyway.
I mean, that's what people say. And they think she sounds common. So, what can I say? I think there's still quite a lot of people from pretty humble backgrounds who are in the Houses of Parliament. Whether you've got the phalanxes that came in the past of horny-handed sons of toil is an entirely different question. And if you think about
Study was
the
strange.
way, if you think about the way that the economy in this country has changed, we don't have huge numbers of people who go down pits and dig coal. We don't have huge phalanxes of miners anymore. The number of people who work in a car factory where, Fords in Dagenham at one point employed, I don't know, 40,000 people. You can now run a car assembly plant with millions of robots and 20, 2,000 people. So there just aren't the numbers of people in those kind of roles anymore. So, and of course, once you reduce the numbers of people who do that kind of job, then obviously there will be a reduction in the number of those people who are available to be picked from to go into Parliament. But I still think there's quite a cross-section of people who've done all kinds of jobs and come from fairly humble beginnings in Parliament from the new Labour intake. I don't think it's right to suggest that it's suddenly just sort of upper middle class millionaires or something like that
So
who've been
there's
coming
no
in.
social engineering going on here, but there is an evisceration economically of some of the traditional roots, for example, the union movement. And Mal, do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, Lone is obviously right. Yeah, there is a much smaller pool of what would go. I'm not even sure that the term working class and middle class mean anything terribly much
Rather like left and
anymore.
right, up to a point.
I mean, the big divisions now in society, I think, have moved away from traditional class and have moved more towards age. I mean, if you look at voting intentions, age is the absolutely big one. There is part of me that wonders why the government has regarded pensioners as taking the fuel payments away, maybe taking the single council tax discount away, which of course disproportionately accepts with affects elderly widowed people who are more likely to live on their own, and removing free bus passes is being talked about. A series of measures that seem targeted at pensioners. The over 70s was the only demography that voted Conservative in the last election. And as you go down through the ages, the younger people get, the more likely they are to vote throughout Labour. So these are where the new divisions are appearing in society across, rather than the old ones where you could get a fairly clear picture from occupation as to whether someone was working class or middle class. And indeed, the strongest support for Labour tends to be among graduates who would traditionally have been, you know, recognised as being middle class. So I think that's true. I still think there is a... Parliament is... There's been a lot of very welcome reforms, and the fact there are a lot more women in Parliament, I think, is not only a good thing in itself, but it's an indication that I think there have been useful reforms in Parliament that make it more possible for women who still, you know, tend to have more domestic responsibilities than men in most households. Nonetheless, those reforms have made it more attractive for women. And I think that's clearly a good sign.
Yeah, working hours are a bit better than they were, I guess, yeah, for example.
Yeah, exactly. The all-night sittings, all of that kind of thing. There's still... it's still very difficult, I think, for people of working age. And the other thing, clearly, is the level of abuse, again, particularly towards women in Parliament. I think a lot of politicians, unfortunately, in Parliament do behave badly and you know, encourage criticism. But it too often falls over into abuse. And whether it's, you know, Angela Rayner or Nigel Farage or whoever it is who's getting this kind of nasty personal attacks, I think if we want
to... can't do local surgeries because of the level of protection required. In Clacton-on-Sea, for goodness sake. I mean, throw their teeth, surgical stockings.
Our council is just putting on training for councillors now about personal safety, which is not something I ever remember before. And I think the Labour group had their session recently, and I think the Conservatives might have had theirs, and Labour, it's coming up with Labour, the other way around. But yes, and yeah, we all remember Joe Cox and David Amos.
Yeah.
It's necessary for people like Leonie and me to be able to meet people face to face and talk to them. We need, in a surgery, if someone's coming to talk to us about a difficult problem with a neighbour or a very personal issue to do with social care or whatever it happens to be, quite often it's taken them quite a bit of courage to come and talk to us in the first place. To have someone sitting there in the room alongside us, it makes it very difficult. So I don't think we can bow down to these fears, but equivalently, we do need to recognise that it's a more hostile environment for many politicians now than it was before. And I think all of us, you know, in our own personal talk as politicians, need to be careful that we keep clear the line between criticism of policy and behaviour as legitimate and allowing that to fall over into out-and-out hatred sometimes.
It sounds a bit like people, you know, that somebody, as it were, leapfrogging on the or piggybacking on the notion of people being voiceless in order to do ad hominem attacks, or at least the optics of the threat of that becoming a thing. Leonie, what's your experience of this? I hope very much you haven't needed personal protection. I suspect not on your home turf. You do, of course, have the noble hounds.
Well, they of course, would be hopeless because they are so friendly. They would probably love bomb somebody who is, and also I tend not to take them to my counsellor surgeries because not everybody is a fan of dogs. So
not to love.
I mean, it's hard to believe that there would be somebody in the world that doesn't like a spaniel, but apparently there are. So I mean, we had to shut all our surgeries down in Wandsworth this time last year, because a councillor was attacked in while she was doing her surgery in Tooting Library. Risk assessed all the venues again. And actually in Firstdown, we used to do them in two venues, and we risk assessed one of the venues as not being suitable because there was nobody else in the building and it was quite in a more obscure location. So we relocated all of the surgeries to the one venue. And there's always somebody else in the building doing something else. A local
That's
resident.
A low-key manner. Yeah.
It's actually a local artist who runs art classes for children. So when I arrived...
Projectiles there, but benign ones.
I just did the surgery at the beginning of this month. And in fact, one of my colleagues cancelled the second surgery in July. We do 2 a month. Because she'd heard that somebody who... is quite volatile was going to come to it. So she cancelled the whole thing. So, of course, and we don't do them in August because there's usually not enough people around. So the first one in September, of course, the volatile guy turns up at my surgery because she's cancelled hers. He's been to many surgeries, different counsellors. He's gone down to Tooting Library and spoken to counsellors from other wards. He does actually live in Firstown. So, of course, you know, about the first 20 minutes of the surgery were quite difficult. And then he started shouting at me, and I'd let the woman running the art class know that I'd arrived and that I was conducting a surgery and that I had someone with me before I went and sat down in private with him. So I opened the door and asked him to leave. But of course, at that point, she arrived from the art class in the other room and said, "Is everything okay?" Because I'd primed her to know that I was with someone. And you just have to think these things through.
Expertly done.
And I put him in a chair very close to the door to the building, yes. Which I opened and ushered him out, still shouting. In fact, he started shouting at me even before we got into the surgery on the street corner.
And he hasn't yet got a job on GB News.
Well, and let's hope he doesn't. But it's that sort of thing that we have to put up with, that I agree with Malcolm. I've not been a councillor for quite as long as Malcolm, but I have been serving as a councillor for quite some years. And in the past, nobody would have dreamt of coming to a councillor's surgery and saying, you know, you're useless, and then start shouting their head off in such an offensive way. That would just never have happened. But we still have to have the private surgeries with people, I think. I mean, a lot of MPs now do surgeries online and don't meet with people in a room. So, you know, it's very tricky how you choose to respond to these threats, because obviously nobody does want to be attacked. Nobody obviously clearly wants to have a Joe Cox or a David Amis situation. But before Joe Cox was murdered, when was in 2016, when was the previous MP who was murdered in a surgery? And she was on the way to her surgery and was attacked in the street. And David Amis was in his surgery when he was attacked. So, I mean, it does leave you quite vulnerable, because people know you're going to be there. They know the time that you're going to be there. You advertise it publicly. You say anyone can drop in without an appointment, or at least that's what we do with our council surgeries. I think MPs are now making people make appointments as well.
They can be bettered a bit. Yeah.
It's very tricky. It's very tricky, because we do still need to be there for the public, so that people who have got an extreme problem can come and talk to you. But at the same time, nobody wants to, you know, encourage the axeman into their house. It's a real contradiction.
And it takes a great deal of bravery. I salute you both for holding out for this. I think therein lies the solution. Thank you both very much. Have a great weekend.
And you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Speak soon. Bye-bye.